You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, can be one, many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Teamsters Joint Council 56 and USW District 11. Teamsters Joint Council 56 and our nine local unions represent 30,000 workers, retirees, and their families in western Missouri, Kansas, and Nebraska. We are proud to support the Heartland Labor Forum and their commitment to give working families a voice in the greater Kansas City community. And United Steelworkers District 11, representing 33,000 members in the Midwest, protecting worker rights and organizing the unorganized, we support union-made products. And we thank our underwriters for their contributions to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, we talk to Lane Windham about her new book, Knocking on Labor's Door, Union Organizing in the 1970s and the Roots of the New Economic Divide. Through close-up studies of workers' campaigns in shipbuilding, textiles, retail, and service, Windham overturns widely held myths about labor's decline, showing instead how employers united to manipulate weak labor law and quash a new wave of worker organizing. Then, we talk to Rod Chappelle to find out why the Missouri NAACP asked their national organization to issue its first travel advisory, warning people of color to travel at their own risk through Missouri. In the news, Target raises wages to $15, and Mexican official indicates willingness to accept enforceable labor rights standards if they can maintain access for their exports to the U.S. and Canadian markets in the NAFTA revision. Our feature at the end of the show is Washington Window on Workers. We'll talk taxes. Now for the news.
And this is the news from our side, September 28, 2017. The Citizens Trade Campaign has been closely monitoring the NAFTA rewrite negotiations between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. They report that the U.S. and Canada have been pressuring Mexico to accept revision to the weak labor standards in NAFTA side agreements by incorporating enforceable standards which would improve working conditions. That they would trade this for keeping duty-free entry into U.S. and Canadian markets for Mexican exports. This means Mexico would not agree to changes in rules of origin which stipulate greater U.S. content requirements to goods, but improving labor standards in Mexico could decrease the incentives of employers to move there for cheaper wages. Most union leaders prefer the Canadian language on labor standards to the Trump administration's proposals, but the Canadians have yet to spell out how much a living wage should be. At least U.S. Trade Representative spokesperson Emily Davis has finally admitted that the NAFTA labor records or NAFTA labor accords were toothless. However, Canadian union leader Jerry Diaz of Unifor, their largest private sector union, said that the American labor proposals simply mirror the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal, which the U.S. abandoned, and which set the bar too low for enforcement. Diaz said it does not allow for human rights violations to be considered as unfair trade practices, and Mexico would exploit such gaps. Canadian unions have also been critical of weak U.S. labor rights, particularly so-called right-to-work laws. Juan Gallardo, a Mexican businessman who was also part of Mexico's business advisory group at the talks, rejected the idea that other countries should impose minimum wages and working conditions on Mexican workers. dictating wage increases from abroad is simply not going to happen, he told reporters. Mexico is happy to consider suggestions with the understanding that each country obviously has the right and obligation to set its own working standards, Gallardo said. The Mexican minimum wage today is less than $4 a day and hasn't risen since NAFTA was signed in 1993.
Political tensions are running high in Catalonia in northeastern Spain, where the big port city of Barcelona is. Catalan separatists have called for an election for Sunday to vote on independence from Spain. Catalan is one of the most prosperous parts of Spain. The Spanish government and courts say the election is illegal, but pro-separatist protests escalated on Wednesday after several senior officials in the regional government were arrested during police raids to confiscate all materials related to the referendum. To quell potential unrest and block the referendum, the Spanish government has chartered a total of 4 cruise ships. They are sitting off the coast of Catalonia, where they are filled with extra police officers. But Barcelona dock workers aren't going to make it easy. According to the Latin American Herald Tribune, the Barcelona Dock Workers Union, OEPB, announced last Thursday that, in order to defend civil rights, they had voted not to cooperate with one of the cruise ships chartered by Spain's Interior Ministry to house police. The Rhapsody cruise ship, which can hold up to 2,500 passengers, is currently in Barcelona's port. Sources at Barcelona's port say the stevedore's decision would have repercussions, but pointed out that this union is usually charged with unloading cargo ships rather than cruise ships such as the Rhapsody, which does not require the same process in order to dock and unload.
The AP reports a second lawsuit is challenging the failure of one of the nation's largest private immigration jails to pay detainees minimum wage for the work they perform. Former detainee Chow Chen filed the class action federal lawsuit Tuesday against the GEO Group, the for-profit company that operates the Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma. Washington Attorney General Bob Ferguson sued the company in state court last week, alleging violations of Washington's minimum wage law. GEO says the center has a volunteer work program and minimum wages rates and standards specified exclusively by the federal government under standards set for detainees in 2011. The company pays $1 per day to detainees for kitchen, cleaning, and janitorial tasks at the 1,500-bed facility. Chen, a Chinese citizen who was detained from 2014 to 2016, is a legal permanent resident of the United States and lives in Renton, Washington.
And finally, with the holiday season approaching this week, Target became the first low-wage chain to announce it will raise pay to $15 an hour. Chief Executive Brian Cornell said the decision to raise wages to $15 by 2020 will help Target attract and retain talent as the hyper-competitive retail sector enters its busiest quarter. It also shows the growing impact of the fight for 15 and puts pressure on other major players like Amazon, Walmart, and McDonald's to follow suit. Part of what's driving employers like Target to pay $15 an hour is the simple fact that everywhere in America, not just on the coasts, a single worker will soon need to earn at least that much just to afford the basics. Since striking fast food workers launched the fight for 15 in 2012, states and cities comprising more than 18% of the U.S. workforce have approved $15 minimum wages. This includes Target's home city of Minneapolis, as well as Kansas City, although we were preempted by the legislature. And scores of companies have raised pay to $15, including insurance giants Aetna and Allstate, major hospital chains across the country, and tech leader Facebook for its contracted bus drivers, janitors, and security guards. But Target's role as an industry leader in retail, which together with restaurants employs the largest share of workers paid less than $15, illustrates that what business strategists have long argued. Historically low-paying sectors can make the shift to significantly higher pay. MIT business professor Zeynep Tan has shown how industry leaders like Costco and Trader Joe's provide a roadmap for how investing in retail workers with good wages and benefits goes hand in hand with strong growth and productivity. That's the news from our side. The news tonight was read by Jen Salmon, Michael Savoir, and I'm Judy Ansel.
To our loved ones and family, bring more than a paycheck. To our loved ones and family,
I wanted more than a paycheck. But what I've got here today is more than I bargained for. When I walk through that door, I bring home my space.
Hi, this is Kim with the Heartland Labor Forum. The power of unions in workers' lives and in the American political system has declined dramatically since the 1970s. In recent years, many have argued that the crisis took root when unions stopped reaching out to workers and workers turned away from unions. But in her book, Knocking on Labor's Door, Lane Wyndham tells a different story, highlighting the integral, often overlooked contributions of women, people of color, young workers, and Southerners. Wyndham reveals how in the 1970s, workers combined old working class tools like unions and labor law with legislative gains from the civil and women's rights movements to help shore up their prospects. Through close-up studies of workers' campaigns in shipbuilding, textiles, retail, and service, Wyndham overturns widely held myths about labor's decline, showing instead how employers united to manipulate weak labor law and quash a new wave of worker organizing. Recounting how employees attempted to unionize against overwhelming odds, Knocking on Labor's Door dramatically refashions the narrative of working-class struggle during a crucial decade and shakes up current debates about labor's future. Wyndham's story inspires both hope and indignation and will become a must-read in labor, civil rights, and women's history. Yesterday, I had an opportunity to interview Lane Wyndham. Lane Wyndham, welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum.
Hi.
Lane, I really enjoyed your book, Knocking on Labor's Door. Can you start by telling us how you came to write this particular book?
Sure, I'd be happy to. You know, there's a way in which I started this book 25 years ago.
Wow.
Because that's when I became a union organizer in the South. I spent a number of years, you know, sitting in working people's living rooms, talking to them about their jobs and their fears about forming a union. And honestly, their fears were really very well founded. Every campaign I worked on, the company, you know, fired people, threatened closure, forced people to attend meetings against the union. And few people really know what happens when people try to form a union in this country. When I returned to grad school, I started to focus on the history of organizing, and I learned that there were a number of really big union elections in the 1970s, and that surprised me, because it's really different than what historians say about the 1970s. They say that that's the decade when workers stopped being interested in unions and unions stopped organizing. But, you know, that didn't seem right to me, and so I began to take a closer look at the data in the National Labor Relations Board elections. And it turns out that there was tons of union organizing and activity in the 70s. Roughly 5 million workers voted in labor board elections in the 70s, half a million a year. What happened, however, is that employers also ramped up their resistance to union organizing, and so they stopped many of these people from effectively forming unions.
So one topic that is interwoven all through the book is social welfare. Can you talk about that and how it's been structured in our country and how that's related to labor struggles?
Sure, I'd be happy to. You know, one of the questions that I had is I knew that employers started to fight union organizing in the 70s, but why? Why would they start to fight with such a vengeance at that point? And answering that question led me to this issue of social welfare. I realized that employers had a huge incentive to resist union organizing because collective bargaining plays a pretty particular role within our very employer-centered social welfare system. So in the U.S., in our social safety net, most people get their pensions, their health care, even their, you know, better wages, all of this, it comes through the employers. And I discussed how this system developed after World War II. But in the U.S., we never said to employers, okay, you have to provide health care or you have to provide pension. Instead, all we said to employers is you have to bargain over these social benefits for these workers who have jumped through all these hoops and formed a union. What it means is that our system relies on unions to basically do the kind of redistribution and social safety network that governments do in other countries. Well, in this country, when the employers faced a profit crisis of profit in the 1970s, they wanted out of that social welfare obligations. Well, what was the best way out? It was to avoid the union that could legally force it to play that role in the first place. And so there's this paradox. Unions sort of became more and more important to people, but at the same time, they became less and less accessible.
Absolutely. Okay, so the 1970s, as you said, was a very active time, actually, in union organizing with all these different and new groups that were struggling to organize. Tell us a little bit about those groups.
Sure. So, you know, what I describe is that there was a wave of millions of working people who were organizing in the private sector, including throughout the South, and many of the people leading these drives were women and people of color who had long been excluded from many of the kinds of jobs that were at our nation's economic core, and they had also been excluded from many unions. But they had won new access through the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And so as they poured into these newly opened jobs, they began to demand unions. They, after all, they didn't just want a job, right? They wanted a really good job. And so tons of surprising union victories. Workers at the West Stock Exchange unionized, thousands of hospital workers, workers at the first foreign auto transplant, Volkswagen in Westmoreland, Pennsylvania organized, even security guards who worked for Pinkerton, the notorious strike-breaking firm, won a union in the 1970s. So, you know, basically the people who gained new access to the heart of our economy were many of the ones who drove this. The women, 12 million more women were working by the end of the decade, and black workers were by far the most likely workers to say that they wanted a union. The AFL-CIO estimated that during this period, one out of every three new union members was African American.
And so there was strong pushback during this same time from anti-union factions, much like in previous eras. But in the 70s, there came this groundswell of anti-union consultants and think tanks, right?
Absolutely. Right. So if what I'm describing is true, that there's all these women and people of color and Southerners who want unions, then what happened, right?
Yeah.
And it's absolutely right that the employers, you know, they'd never been thrilled to have unions, but they dramatically increased their resistance to unions in the 1970s. And three things changed on this front. First, employers became far more willing to bend and break the law. Mm-hmm. The number of what we call unfair labor practice charges, which are, you know, incidents of law breaking, basically, these charges against employers doubled in this decade, as did the number of charges of illegal firings. And that law breaking was effective. You know, workers had won roughly 80% of union elections in the 1940s, but by the 70s, they won less than half. The second thing that happened is that even unionized employers at the core of the economy, manufacturers like GM, U.S. Steel, Goodrich, they began to viciously fight their workers' efforts to form a union, those workers who didn't already have a union. So I look at these unfair labor practices by sector, and it turns out that by the 1970s, workers in manufacturing were more likely to face employer lawbreaking than those even in retail and service. And the final thing employers did was they began to rely much more heavily on union busters. And many of them received their training at our nation's universities that began to teach that good business practices involved resisting union organizing. And these consultants, they knew that there was a diversified workforce, and they bred fear about the new levels of women and people of color in the workforce, and they really used this diversified workforce to gin up business.
Yeah. And globalization, because it has been largely blamed for the weakening and shrinking of union membership, and how did it really factor in from your research?
Right. So I do not mean to say here that globalization and technological change were not important. They
right.
certainly were.
Absolutely.
What happens, though, is when we discuss these issues, often we stop there and don't talk about these other factors. I certainly don't mean to imply that employer resistance was the only factor that weakened unions.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that labor law was too weak to effectively support workers' efforts to form unions, right at this moment when capitalism was globalizing, meant that when those workers faced those big technological and global shifts, they did so on far weaker footing than if they'd been able to form unions. And what that means is that unions' decline has resonated far beyond union members. Research by Jake Rosenfeld and Bruce Western has shown that between one-fifth and one-third of wage inequality today is due to the drop in union density between 1973 and 2007. And so, union shrinkage has a huge impact.
Absolutely, on everyone's jobs. Could labor have done anything to kind of stop the bleeding?
Right. You look at all these factors and say, gosh, really, what could they have done? I think that it likely would have taken a wholesale change of direction in the early 80s while the labor movement was still strong in the private sector. And I discuss one missed opportunity in the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
During this time, labor convened what they called the Committee on the Evolution of Work, which was a sort of top-level commission of some of the nation's top labor leaders. And they spent a few years basically studying the problem, and they looked at entirely new models for representing workers outside the increasingly broken collective bargaining system, such as through associational membership. But in the end, a number of unions scuttled the AFL-CIO's plan on this because they worried that the program would milk unions of resources.
Right.
They weren't sure how it would work with their current structure. A few unions, like the AFT, did experiment with the new forms, but most stuck to the old forms. And what that meant was that workers had a very difficult time entering into unions because labor law employers had effectively, narrowed the door through which workers could enter unions.
Right. And so kind of fast forward, and now we've moved toward like a gig economy, like you say in your book, and labor law hasn't been able to keep up. So what does that really mean and where does that put us?
Right. Good question. In today's gig economy, and it's not just, when people think gig economy, they think Uber, but really what it is that the entire employer relationship mm-hmm. is changing on so many fronts. So employers have basically relinquished not only their social welfare role, but that employer-employee relationship. Workers find, for instance, somebody who works for IBM sweeping the floor. Well, they don't really work for IBM,
right?
They work for a contractor, or they work for a contractor of a contractor.
Right.
And meanwhile, so many workers are considered supervisors when they're not. There's lots of workers in this country who are on guest worker visas, for instance. There's
mm-hmm.
just all sorts of ways that labor law just doesn't cover these workers, and labor law has not kept up with this changing workforce. However, I am pretty hopeful in many ways because I think that there is a new breed of worker organizations that is doing a lot to address some of these challenges, often working in tandem with unions. So, the groups experimenting with these ways to build power outside of the current labor law, outside of the current collective bargaining system, the National Domestic Workers Alliance, the National Taxi Workers Alliance, the Restaurant Opportunities Center, worker centers, and they've done amazing things. For instance, in San Francisco, they recently passed a retail workers' bill of rights, which basically makes sure that part-timers get equal treatment and that workers have some control over their schedule. That was a product of a struggle waged by traditional unions as well as worker centers and community groups. Mm-hmm. And so I see in some ways that what worker organizations and unions need to do going forward is to basically help to build a new social compact that would include lots of people, not just the union members.
Absolutely. So we've got just a couple of minutes left, and I was just going to give you a minute to just tell us anything else that I didn't ask you that you would like our listeners to know.
Well, you know, as I said, I actually am enormously hopeful at this moment, which is, you know, a lot of people find that strange given the Trump administration, but
right.
I believe that, you know, I've been in the labor movement for 25 years, and I see that we have a very active and diverse working class today. The Economic Policy Institute just came out with a study at Labor Day that shows that two-thirds of union members today are women and or people of color.
Great.
And that transformation really started in the 1970s, and it's part of what I describe in this book. And I'm going to do a quick plug for a new organization that I'm part of called Will Empower, Women Innovating Labor Leadership. It's a joint program with Georgetown University and Rutgers, and it's a program that is designed to identify, nurture, and train a whole new generation of women labor leaders, both within traditional unions and alternative worker organizations. And we're going to have trainings and mentorships and apprenticeships and fellowships. So I would urge people to look for Will Empower, because we are going to be launching this soon.
Absolutely. Well, Lane Windham, you have been wonderful, and I really enjoyed your book, Knocking on Labor's Door, Union Organizing in the 1970s and the Roots of a New Economic Divide. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Lane Windham is Associate Director of Georgetown University's Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor.
Award-winning journalist, author, and Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez is coming to KC for a KKFI benefit on Friday, September 29th at All Souls Unitarian Church, 4501 Walnut, Kansas City, Missouri. Meet and greet VIP dinner at 6 p.m. with talk from Sanctuary Cities to Climate Change at 7:30. $75 meet and greet VIP dinner tickets include an autographed copy of his new book, Reclaiming Gotham. Tickets for the talk only are $20 at $10 for students and unemployed. Tickets available at kkfi.org.
For 30 years, KKFI has been supported by listeners just like you. Thank you for being there for us so we can be there for you. To help sustain independent community radio, go to kkfi.org and click donate.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Barbara Wright.
And I'm Michael Savoie.
And we're joined by Rod Chappell. He is the Missouri NAACP Conference President. On today's show, we want to answer the question, what is the Missouri travel ban and why was it necessary? Welcome, Mr. Chappell.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on.
I'm so glad to have you here. Our audience may be interested in you and how you became involved in the NAACP. We know that you are the Missouri president, but can you tell us a little bit more about your responsibilities and maybe a little bit more about you?
Absolutely. Well, you know, I came to the NAACP almost as a family calling. My parents both were involved in the organization at a young age. My father has a vivid memory of assisting his mother and siblings in picking cotton in one of the accompanying fields, and they used that money to send to the NAACP Legal Defense Fund for the litigation that later became the Brown versus Board of Education. And so I've got a great passion for the organization and the values of equality and justice. I am also a trial lawyer, and so daily I do my best to advocate for those values as a profession. And in my volunteer work with the NAACP, I serve as the president of the Missouri State Conference. That is the, if you can imagine, the umbrella organization over each of the local NAACP units, you know, Kansas City, St. Louis, Jeff City, Columbia. There are many, many units in and around the state, as well as some that are actually even in the prisons and in the colleges around the state, too.
Rod, you know, I'm a black American, and I've been traveling in Missouri for a long, long time with caution.
Yes.
Of course, I came up in an era that mandated that, and it became quite a habit. So our next question was, when was the last travel ban for African Americans? And I would imagine that goes back to the 30s or 40s, the Green.
Well, and I would think so. This is the first one in modern history that has actually been issued by the NAACP in the state of Missouri, or, as I'm told, anywhere in the country. I guess, you know, to be real honest with you, that same knowledge, whether that's handed down through families or custom or just through communities, that says you need to be careful if you're, you know, in this part or you're over here and there, has been, this is the first time to actually articulate it in the form of a travel advisory saying, if you are a person who's traveling in the state of Missouri or who lives in the state of Missouri and maybe moving from one location to another, you need to be careful, because we recognize that there are civil rights violations that have gone on in the past and anticipate that those have not been abated. And so we felt that it was our duty to warn people.
My goodness. And NAACP has been around for 102 years?
Yeah, that's right, since 1909.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. Well, what is included in that travel ban?
Well, and so it's everything. I know that in St. Louis there was some concern that the travel industry was going to take a hit, you know, hotels and conventions and tourism. But it's much larger than that, actually, because if you are a person of color, if you are from if you have an international heritage, have a religious person of any sort, are disabled, perceived as disabled, or if you're female, any of those categories that are historically protected, you're at risk in Missouri. And it's for two reasons. One, we know that people of color and people of different religions have been subjected to what can best be called constitutional civil rights violations, and some of those have ended in death. Now, those are extreme cases. You know, Tori Sanford, who drove into Missouri by accident, ran out of gas outside of Charleston, found the police, and then found out that he was on the inside of a police cell, although had never been charged or even alleged to have committed any crime. And he died very shortly thereafter, less than 24 hours. And we're still looking for an investigation into those facts that has not been completed. Or if you're the folks outside of Kansas City, and it doesn't seem to matter which religion, it's just that folks are different. I mean, there was an individual who attempted to shoot some folks who were Jewish and shot Christians by accident, and he couldn't tell. And then there was another man that attempted to kill some Muslims, or who he thought were Muslims. They were Hindus, and they ended up shooting some other Caucasians with him. So or at least one. And so we've got that kind of anecdotal evidence. And so it's if you're on the roads, but because of the change in law that was signed into law by Eric Greitens that was passed by the Missouri legislature that legalizes individual discrimination. So literally, if someone is renting a house, if somebody is serving a meal, providing educational or health services, and an individual feels discriminated in that context, they will not be able to sue the individual that did it. Now, so if you go to a restaurant and they don't serve you, say it's because of a protected reason, can you still sue the restaurant? The answer is yes. But can you sue the person that refused to serve you? The answer is no. And so for that reason, we felt like it was imperative that people understood, you know, you could literally be denied services. And in some cases, those are necessary services like food and health care, education to be included, and not have any recourse. We think that if people understand that, that they're going to make decisions that, you know, at least are in their own interest, right?
Absolutely. Rod, you're speaking of Senate Bill 43.
Yes, sir.
Has that been signed into law by Governor Greitens?
Regretfully so. On June the 30th, the governor signed that, and it took effect on August 28th of 2017.
Wow. I've read some of the reasons that the travel ban was issued, and you covered most of them. When I read about Tori Sanford, it really touched my heart because I have 30-year-old sons, and I'm an African-American, and I feel, I'm constantly praying for my 30-year-old sons, and they're good young men, they're great fathers and all that, but no one is exempt. It doesn't matter that you're a great father, you go to work, you do what you're supposed to do, and 75% more African Americans are stopped, and Hispanic, as well as Hispanic drivers are searched more than anyone else. Some of the other things that I had read about this ban, and I appreciate you having the gall to stand up, you know, for what is right. I mean, you guys are out there on the front lines, you know, pretty much just like our military in cases out there by yourself. And it seems like so much has been going on. It didn't receive the press that it could have received. But I applaud you guys for standing up. But my next question is, have you received national support? You talked about the other NAACP units locally, statewide, national chapters. Have you received support?
We have, and you know that's one thing that I have to say about the national organization. You know, we've got good leadership there, and Derek Johnson, who is the interim president of the organization. You know, immediately after we put this travel ban advisory into place, we let the governor know that it was in. He moved forward and he signed this terrible bill, Senate Bill 43, the one that legalizes discrimination. And then after that, on July the 4th of all days, instead of celebrating, we made the travel advisory permanent. Once we did that, we went to Baltimore for the annual convention in July. We brought the issue up in front of delegates from across the United States, and some people travel internationally to be there. And the delegates voted, just without any dissent, to pass the resolution recognizing the travel advisory, telling everybody in the United States who's an NAACP member or supporter that these issues are in effect in the state. And so we've had phenomenal support from the national organization, and I'm deeply appreciative of that.
Well, I'm appreciative of you because I was looking at some more research. I mean, this made me go and research some things that I had not researched before, and I have learned so much, and I have a little following, so I've informed those that are following me, look around, because Missouri has more hate groups from, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, than any other state around us, like Nebraska, Iowa, Kansas, Oklahoma. You would think maybe they do. Missouri has 24 different hate groups, the white separatists and neo-Nazis. So I appreciate, again, you guys shining light on this situation, because maybe those of us in Missouri did not realize some of the things that we're up against, even though if you live here, you might have experienced some of the things. I appreciate you.
Yes. Well, you know, I mentioned, Rod, that I was, I became of age in the 60s, and I can remember as a child very vividly, we would make the annual pilgrimage to Louisiana, and my dad would avoid driving through Mississippi. Now, that's not to say that Missouri and Arkansas and Louisiana were much better, but he very specifically would avoid Mississippi. And it kind of harkens back to that era that blacks just kind of intuitively knew what was safe, what wasn't safe, and how to act accordingly. And we're once again witnessing this kind of hostility, whether it's subtle or not so subtle, on our roads and in our laws. Are they being redefined or readdressed? So I think certainly it's commendable that we're drawing attention to it, and I think that attention has been national and international. But could you tell us what African Americans could do to help them avoid the legal conflicts?
I remember the first time I got that question, and it was in a small group, and I thought, well, you know, maybe it's just as simple as, you know, telling people when you travel in or around the state, or making sure that somebody would be able to come and get you. And I mean, immediately, if it's terms of bailing out, we still have problems with these municipalities that put people in jail and don't provide bail. And a matter of fact, just in St. Louis, over the weekend, they arrested, I believe it was 22 people, some of those under very questionable circumstances. And I understand that they've got legal issues that are pending, but they those were for trespass. And so they arrested them, would not let lawyers see them, and would not let them bail out, right? And at the same time, did medical treatment to people who were there that had some need. So at this point, I would say be very careful. And if you don't mind, I'll make an announcement on behalf of the NAACP that is new since our annual meeting that we had in Springfield just this past weekend. We're developing a resource because there are certain places in Missouri that, in our opinion, have demonstrated that they are more dangerous than others, just to be very candid. And one of those, just based on recent occurrences, is going to be St. Louis and St. Louis County. If you go there, and if you're a person trying to exercise your First Amendment rights to free speech, to protest, there are folks who have had a very negative response from law enforcement. I think it was quoted in the newspaper as a police riot. And their constitutional concerns there. And, you know, when we talk about constitutional concerns, these aren't the esoteric, I sure would be able to, like to be able to do this or do that, and I don't understand why I can't, or, you know, what happens if I do. These are, we've been brutalized, such as the 13-year-old child that was tackled, or the 86-year-old reverend, female reverend, who, there's a very ugly picture out there where an officer has his hand on her throat. I don't know where in America we are anymore. And so to get back to your question, what we need to do at this point is really assess where we go and who we are. Because the people who we used to think that were at risk, in general, black men, are no longer the primary targets of some of this activity and conduct. We see that it's children and grandmothers, too.
Wow. Is there a time frame for the travel ban?
No. At this point, we started discussions and talks with a number of folks, such as the University of Missouri, who, by the way, has terminated everybody who was engaged in the decision to support Senate Bill 43, because we brought that issue up with them, because, and many people said it, that maybe we shouldn't use tax money to support Jim Crow era legislation. They've walked away from that, and they've demonstrated their commitment to diversity and equality, and most importantly, to educating everybody on a fair standard. And so we deeply appreciate that. But there are other institutions, such as the Missouri Chamber of Commerce, who on the one hand would complain that the travel advisory is costing the state of Missouri economic opportunities for some of their members, but on the other hand, seem to deny the realities that Missouri used to have good jobs, protected, that were civil rights of the individuals who were workers and consumers, were protected. And that had a value. In general, the salary and benefits that we received. Now, without the protections, those jobs do not have the same value. And I think that that's a very important thing to recognize, but we're still working with them to come to that sort of an understanding. And so I don't think that the travel advisory can be really looked at as something that needs to be altered or moved until the civil rights violations in the area of the criminal justice system, whether that's on the road or in the courthouse, is evaluated and some recommendations instituted to repair those violations or as a remedy. Likewise, the civil courts need the doors to be open. You cannot legalize discrimination against an entire group of people or groups and think that that's going to be okay.
Yep. Well, Rod, we're down about our two-minute mark.
Okay.
Is there anything else you would like to share with our Heartland Labor Forum audience?
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, communities around the state are coming together. Sometimes it's around civil rights violations and tragedies such as we have in St. Louis. Sometimes it's around issues where there's just room for improvement or continuing dialogue. In mid-Missouri, there's an issue where four high school students recently posed with some swastikas and some racial epithets and thought that that was a good thing to share on social media. We're having discussions about that. I would encourage that people of good heart and good nature come together, whether that's through a religious organization or a civic organization, and use this as an opportunity, this awakening throughout the state and the nation, to fight for the values that we as Americans hold dear, equality and justice for all. If the NAACP can help or play a role in that, we certainly want to. We're an organization that is open to everyone, regardless of color, and would love to have the support and encouragement of those in or outside of communities in which we are.
Mr. Chappell, we really thank you for being out there on the front lines for us.
Thank you. And I got to tell you, I love your show and can't wait to share it with our members and friends. So thank you very much.
Wonderful. Thanks also to you out there for listening to the Heartland Labor Forum. And we hope you found the show informative. I'm Barbara Wright.
And I'm Michael Savoie. And we're certainly glad to be on tonight with Rod Chappell. Rod, thank you again. And we certainly appreciate you. We'll send you a link to it where you can get our podcast.
Hey, thank you. Thank mm-hmm. you very much. And if there's ever an opportunity to allow me to come back, please let me.
We certainly will. Thank you and good night.
Thanks. Take
Hi, this is Judy Ansel, and it's Washington Window on Workers. And with me on the phone from Washington, D.C. is Mark Grunberg. How are you, Mark?
I'm fine, thanks. Good evening, everybody.
And good evening to you. So you've been writing in your news compendium this week about taxes and Trump's tax plan, and evidently Richard Trumka, the president of the AFL-CIO, had some not-so-kind words for the tax plan. Tell us about it.
Well, he said that this is, again, just like other Republican tax plans, take from the poor, give to the rich. But then he went beyond that. He said the failed trickle-down theory, which you've tried before, will, of course, short revenues. That will lead to demands to cut things that really help workers and families, like Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security.
So well, that's not,
road,
this could be a real, that's not in his proposal.
And this is my word, Trojan horse.
I see. So how does that work? I know that they're planning on cutting the tax rate for corporations significantly. They're cutting mm-hmm. the estate tax, which they love to call the death tax, which I think is ridiculous. It's the tax on super-duper rich people who die. and they want to get rid of that. That would directly benefit Trump. In fact, a lot of this would benefit Trump, wouldn't it?
Oh, yes, it would. But something that Trump himself denied at a press conference yesterday.
Yeah.
Another thing that would benefit him, they'd get rid of the alternative minimum tax. That's the tax on the very rich who could otherwise use all their exemptions to get money back or pay nothing at all, Trump included, obviously. They would kill that one, too. In short, there's a lot in this bill for the 1% and not that much for the rest of us. The Trump's top economist, Gary Cohn of the National Economic Council, admitted in an interview today, I just heard this on NPR about two hours ago, that some middle income voters, wage earners, might see their taxes go up. But he said, well, your typical middle-class family is going to see a tax cut. Typical middle-class family for Gary Cohn, they asked him, what is that, $100,000?
Oh. Well, yeah, actually, right. That is now the median income for a family in the United States, around $100,000. So maybe he's not that far off. However, you know, that means that half of the people make less than that. And I guess they're not considered middle class.
And that's pretty far off because the median income where half make above and half below is now around $55,000 or $60,000, not $100,000.
You're talking about, I'm not so sure. Well, maybe it was the average. I'll have to check those statistics.
Yeah.
Anyway, you know, Trump said, quote, our framework includes our explicit commitment that tax reform will protect low-income and middle-income households, not the wealthy and well-connected. They can call me all they want. It's not going to help. I'm doing the right thing, and it's not good for me. Believe me. So, you know, it seems like there's this transition going on with Trump. He used to just, you know, sort of distort the truth. Now he's like flat out lying.
Yeah, and indeed, that was a point made. I saw it in today's paper that he's graduated to just constant lying, and in so many words, that's what Trump said, that Trump's comments about this plan were one big fat lie. He didn't use the word lie, but we did in our story, and Rich basically said the same thing. The head of the Alliance for Retired Americans, Richard Fiesta, said, yeah, this plan will benefit people if you make $400,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How many people do we know make $400,000 a year?
So what's the policy? Yeah, well, so what's the, not too many of my friends, but anyway, what's the politics around this? Do they have so much control of Congress that they're going to be able to ram this thing through? I heard that...
They're going to try.
Yeah, they're going to want to do it with special rules so that the Democrats can't filibuster. It's kind of like they tried to do with the health care thing.
That's exactly why they've dropped health care. They're going to use that same reconciliation rule to try to get 50 votes plus one for the one being Mike Pence, of course, to ram this thing through. Now, the catch is, can they do it? Well, there's going to be that handful of Republican senators. Susan Collins comes to mind. Lisa Murkowski comes to mind. Maybe Rob Portman, although that's doubtful. The guy's a former budget director, and you don't know which way he wants to go.
Mm-hmm.
Come to mind. We're going to say, hey, wait a minute. This may not help your regular working families, especially Collins and Murkowski. The catch is to find a third senator besides Collins and Murkowski.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to be back out in the streets again between now and November, if not December, trying to stop this thing.
Are they sure they can hold all the Democrats?
Yeah, that's the other thing. The question is, can they hold their... There are three in particular they have to be concerned about. Three who are up next year in very, very red states, Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota, Joe Manchin of West Virginia, and Joe Donnelly of Indiana. Heitkamp, that is probably more solid than the other two. She's a former state auditor, state revenue commissioner. She knows thing. She knows about numbers in so many words, and she'd be. I would guess she'd be more inclined to be skeptical.
Okay.
But she's got a state that went 70-30 for Trump.
Well, okay, so we're gonna cross our fingers on Claire McCaskill. I want to switch topics because you had another really interesting article about a reporter from who's a member of the Newspaper Guild. That's his union, from the St. Louis newspaper, St. Louis Post, who was arrested in the demonstrations this last week in St. Louis, maced and roughed up by the cops for failing to move when there was no place for him to move. What's this about?
What that was about is he was covering the demonstrations, and there were several other reporters who were also arrested, but they weren't guild members. But he was covering the demonstrations. The cops put them, rounded everybody up in something they called a kettle on your stove, with no place for everybody to go, and basically arrested everybody.
And maced him.
But with him, even though he had his press credentials in open view, told him, I'm a reporter, I'm doing my job, I'm standing here on the curb taking notes, or shooting with his cell phone. Actually, that's what he was doing. They threw him to the ground. They used the zip ties on him. They stood on his neck and gave him several injuries, hauled him off to the station and left him there for 13 hours and wouldn't tell the editor who came by only 2 hours later, oh, we've got him.
Wow.
Guess what?
We're out of time. But I think people should know about this because that is in our state here in Missouri. And I guess these are the same cops who were yelling, whose streets are streets.
And this is also a pattern. This is a pattern that's been developing where law enforcement officers have been going after reporters because the reporters are reporting on things that law enforcement officers don't want reported on. Or their bosses.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Mark. We'll talk to you next month. And hopefully it's cheerier news. Bye-bye.
Okay.
And now for the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. Don't forget Juan Gonzalez tomorrow night. It's going to be an amazing talk about how our cities are changing and also some immigration issues. That's at 6 o'clock for the dinner, 7:30 for the talk at All Souls UU Church, 4501 Walnut. Go to kkfi.org/events for tickets. Human rights violations in Turkey, Saturday, September 30th, 10:30 a.m. at the Dialogue Institute, 4215 Shawnee Drive in Kansas City, Kansas. RSVP for the brunch to Kansas City at thedialogueinstitute.org. The Kansas ACLU is kicking off a national movement to protect the right to vote this Sunday, October 1st at 6 p.m. at the Lead Center in Lawrence, Kansas. Jobs with Justice Organizing Committee, monthly meeting, Tuesday, October 3rd, 6:30 p.m., All Souls UU Church. And Empower Missouri, Persisting and Organizing to Win, POW, Persisting and Organizing to Win, 2017 Annual Conference, is Thursday, October 5th and Friday, October 6th at the Sheraton Clayton Plaza Hotel in St. Louis. Go to empowermissouri.org for more information. You can find our calendar on our webpage at heartlandlaborforum.org, where you can also find archive shows and our upcoming schedule. Tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. Our show is called Disabling Medicaid and the Brotherhood of Maintenance of Way Uniting Rail Workers. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zeman. You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.kkfi.org. www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.